The gospel lesson this morning comes from Luke chapter 12 and verses 13 through 34. Luke chapter 12, beginning to read at verse 13. Certain one in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And he said, "Man, who constituted me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Watch out and be on your guard against every sort of covetousness, because one's life does not consist in the abundance of what belongs to him." And he told them a parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded bumper crops. And he kept debating with himself, saying, "What shall I do? Because I don't have any place to store my crops." He said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my storage houses, and I will build greater ones. And that's where I'll store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have many good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, enjoy yourself.'" And God said to him, "Fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And these things which you have prepared, whose will they be?" That's how it is with the one who gathers treasures for himself and does not gather riches for God. Then he said to the disciples, "Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious for your life, what you should eat, or for your body, what you should put on. For the life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They do not sow crops, nor harvest them. They do not have storerooms, nor storehouses. Yet God feeds them. How much more you are worth than the birds? And which of you, by being anxious, is able to add a cubit's length on his span of life? If therefore you are not able to do what is least, why should you be anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They don't labor nor spin their cloth. But I tell you, not even Solomon in all his splendor could dress himself like one of these. Now, if God so clothes the grass that is in the field today, and that tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And you, don't seek what you should eat or what you should drink, and don't be of anxious mind. For the pagans of the world keep seeking all these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, keep on seeking his kingdom, and these things shall be granted you as well. Don't be afraid, little flock, because your Father delights to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give alms. Make money bags for yourselves that never wear out, with unfailing treasure in the heavens, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be as well. Well, next Sunday is Stewardship Sunday, and this Sunday is the Sunday when you have the Stewardship Sermon before Stewardship Sunday. So hold on to your wallets and clutch your purses and relax, because I never, hardly ever preach a sermon urging you to give. So now that you're relaxed, I'll tell you why I don't preach sermons urging you to give. It's because of what my father once said when he was pacing the floor with his hands in his pockets as he would, and when he would give his choice bits of wisdom. He said, you know, if you have people that are praying and reading their Bibles and walking with the Lord, you don't need to say much about giving, it just comes in. Now, you may not agree with that, or you may. I happen to, and that's why I don't preach sermons on giving. Because if a church isn't giving, a sermon on giving isn't going to help it if people aren't praying and reading their Bibles and walking with the Lord. If a church isn't giving, the problem's much deeper than any sermon on giving can ever touch. So we won't even mess with that, but it is a time in this season of the year and of our church's life when we do give attention to stewardship, and the Bible does have something to say about how we view and use and think about our possessions and wealth and goods and so on. And so that's fair game for us, I'd say, and it's important to know whether we're a fool or not in that regard, and so we ought to pay attention to what Jesus says when he teaches us about it. Well, it was that fellow who wanted some free legal help, and he asked Jesus to speak to his brother to divide the inheritance with him, and Jesus used that to hit the keynote of what he was to say. He said, "Watch out! Be on your guard against every sort of covetousness." And then he launched into a parable or story about a rich fool. And of course, you can tell he's a rich fool. No, he's a fool, even if God hadn't called him one in the story, because he talks. And you can tell from what he says that he's a fool, because he has three speeches in verses 17, 18, and 19, and you can tell that he has a false estimate of things in what he says, particularly in verse 19. You see that this rich fool had a false estimate of time. He said, "Of many goods laid up for many years, but God said this night your souls requires." There's a false estimate of time and a false estimate of purpose. He said, "Take life easy." But Jesus said he didn't gather riches for God. He had a false estimate of purpose. He had a false estimate of control. He said, "You have many goods." And God said, "You don't have them at all. These things which you've prepared, whose will they be? You don't really have them." He had a false estimate of time, or value, rather. Or he said, "You have many goods." But he hadn't noticed the one value, your soul, is required of you. And so, you have this rich fool. And then, that makes quite an impact, doesn't it? No, it really doesn't, by and large. I think most of us read this and look at this and we say, "Well, so, that's not me, but he sure was a dirty, rotten materialist. He really was filthy. I'll bet he even commercialized Christmas. I'll bet he strung Christmas lights around his silos, and he probably piped silver bells over the intercom in his dairy barn. I'll bet he..." But that's not me, you see. I'm not filthy rich like him. And so, this really doesn't faze me. And that's why I think Jesus works on us here like Mr. McCamley, my ninth grade Algebra 1 teacher, did. Mr. McCamley had a strange way about him, in the sense that he would do something like this. He would start talking and he would start asking a question, see. And he would look right at someone. He would fasten on them. For instance, not to pick on anybody, but Rick LeMason here. He would be walking up to Rick as Rick was at the table in Algebra 1, and he would look at Rick all the time that he was saying these things, asking this question, going over him, and Rick just knew that he was going to ask them, and he would have to answer this, and he just kept him in his gaze, and he didn't look anywhere else, and when he finished the question, he would say, "Now, what do you say about that, Ed Barnes?" And Ed might be caught by surprise. The one thing you could be sure of after you were in there for a while, that is, if Mr. McCamley looked at you when he was asking you the question, you probably wouldn't have to answer it. But anyone else was on pins and needles but didn't know that. That's what Jesus is doing here. You see, he's talking about this rich fool, and he's talking to a rich fool. And you begin to think, "Oh, no, that's not me." And then all of a sudden he turns and says, "Now, don't you think that you're not involved here?" Because I think Jesus probably knows that most of us don't really identify with the rich farmer here. And so Jesus says in verse 22, it says, he said to his disciples, not many of them were necessarily filthy rich, "Therefore I say to you, don't be anxious about your life, what you eat, or what about your body, what you put on." Do you see that "therefore"? Someone has said, you know, every time you see a "therefore" in Scripture, you should stop and see what it's there for. And that pertains here. Jesus seems to assume that the teaching he's given here and the story about the rich fool has some relevance to his disciples, even though they aren't in exactly the same situation. "Therefore, I tell you," this has something to say to you after all. And pick up on the keynote back in verse 15, and we can perhaps get a grip on that. Jesus said, "Watch out and be on your guard against every sort of covetousness." Every sort of covetousness. You see, covetousness can take various forms. It can take the form of the rich fool, greed over what he has. But it can also take the form of a poor fool, anxiety over what I don't have, or over what I don't think I have or not have enough of. So you can be a rich fool, but you can also be a poor fool. For the person whose life is focused merely on life's essentials, and they are essential, but we mustn't make life's essentials life's mission, as someone has written. And we can, if we're so anxious over what we eat, over what we drink, over the basic necessities of life, then we're really in the same position as the rich fool. We're really saying, yes, we do agree that life does consist in the abundance, or lack of abundance, of the things one possesses. It's just that we don't have the same kind of bank account, but we have the same mentality. And so Jesus is trying to teach us here how not to be a poor fool. I think he gives us several directions. How not to be a poor fool. If we don't want to be a poor fool, then what should we do? First, get your thinking straight. Get your thinking straight. Verses 22 through 28 of Jesus' teaching. In case you're interested, we want to spend most of our time on this. Now, Jesus says, "Do not be anxious for your life, what you eat, nor about your body, what you put on, for your life is more than food," etc. You see that little word "for"? You see what Jesus is doing? We've got a problem with an overabundance of anxiety over our provisions and our necessities of life and our making a living, as we call it, and so on. Jesus addresses that anxiety, and he begins to comes to us through the means of thinking, through giving us reasons, through giving us rational arguments. He's addressing your mind. He says, "Don't be anxious because of these reasons." It's interesting. Something like this. This anxiety has us in its grip. And Jesus comes through us through the channel of the mind and addresses our thinking and our reasoning, and he brings arguments. Now, what's he say about getting our thinking straight? Well, he brings arguments. Let's try to summarize them. For instance, in verse 23, he gives us an argument from provision. He says, "Your life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing." What's he mean there? Well, he's saying if God provides you with life, then surely He will provide you with the lesser gift, namely food, to sustain that life. If He's provided you with the body, which is the greater gift, surely He'll provide you with what you need to put on that body, the lesser gift. So it's that argument from provision. If He's provided the one, the greater, surely He will provide the lesser. Argument from provision. And then He gives us an argument from value. From value. Notice He says in 24 as well as in 27 and 28, but look at 24, consider the ravens or the crows. It's the same family, same idea. Word can be taken either way. Consider the ravens. They do not sow crops. They do not harvest crops. They do not have storeroom or storehouse, yet God feeds them, etc. You see how important the way we think is to Jesus? He says, consider, set your mind down upon the ravens. It's that very same verb, the same Greek verb is used in Hebrews 3:1, where you have that marvelous text that says, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession. Consider Jesus. But now you see Jesus is saying there are times when you need to consider the crows. Think about the ravens. Think about the crows. Think. How important thinking is. How crucial it is. You saw how important it was with the story of the rich farmer. Because in verses 17, 18, and 19, he's doing nothing but thinking. He's talking to himself. He's thinking. And he's deliberating. And Jesus said in verse 17 that he was debating with himself. What shall I do? You know, I don't have any place to store my crops and so on. He was thinking all the time. You see how important his thinking is, because his thinking and what he was saying to himself was a revelation of his character and where his heart was. You see, if you read verse 19, you see where his heart was by his thinking. So your thinking is very vital. It's very important. What do you say to yourself? You say, oh, you don't think I talk to myself, do you? Oh, yes, you do. I do. Not out loud, because that would embarrass me. And you wouldn't do it out loud usually because that would embarrass you. But you talk to yourself. You talk to yourself when you go to work in the morning. You talk to yourself on the way home. You talk to yourself various times. You say, I wonder if I should get that gallon of milk at this Heise right here near this stoplight. Or should I go on to the Super Fresh or the Giant down the road? I wonder what you... Doesn't matter whether you're always thinking, you're always talking to yourself, you're deliberating. And what do you say to yourself when you're talking to yourself about more important things? That tells you something about where your heart is. Your thinking is important. And so Jesus says, since we think that thinking is important, think about, consider the ravens. And if you consider the ravens, you realize that they don't sow seed, they don't harvest crops, they don't have storeroom or storehouses or silos to put their goods into, yet God feeds them. How much more you are worth than the birds? The argument from value. Think about those ravens. Think about those crows. Well, think about it. Ravens in Leviticus 11:15 and Deuteronomy 14:14, ravens were prohibited for the people of Israel to eat. Israel was not allowed to eat ravens because they were on the unclean list. And perhaps part of the reason was they're scavengers and so on, and they were not allowed to be eaten in the diet of Israel in the Old Testament period. And so when Jesus says, consider the ravens, he's talking about unclean birds, which Jews would regard as unclean birds. God even feeds the dirty birds. How much more are you of value than they? So you ought to think twice. Consider the ravens as you drive down the highway someday and you happen to see these shiny dark creatures, two or three of them, picking away at their meal on this smished skunk that some motorist before you has run over. And when you come along, these dark shiny creatures fly off until you go by and they can return to their dinner time, and you see in your rearview mirror that they're doing just that. And consider the ravens And you ought to begin to sing then as you see them. Great is thy faithfulness, O God my Father. You even feed the dirty birds, how much more? You will feed me, for you said, you are of far more value than they. Think about the crows. And Jesus also says, consider the lilies, verse 27. It's the same argument from value. Consider the lilies, how they grow. They don't toil, they don't spin, they don't spin their material in order to clothe themselves. But I tell you, not even Solomon in all his splendor could dress himself like one of these. So therefore, again, the argument from value, if God so clothes those lilies of the field, those wild flowers, how much more we clothe you? And we don't know what that lily was exactly. Some think it was a flower something like our daisy. Others think it was a yellow, basically an all-yellow flower. Others think it was probably a red flower. But at any rate, it was one of the common wildflowers that commonly grew in Palestine. Consider the lilies. And the point that Jesus is making here is that God seems to be so very wasteful to take all that care and to put all that creative energy into just making one of these lilies or wildflowers. It's as if you see the supreme designer looking at this single lily or flower, and he says to himself, I want to add just a dash of color here, and I want to add just a touch of elegance and gracefulness here. I want people, when they look at this, to be able to say, how happy and delightful the creator of this flower must be. And we would say in our typical American 20th century pragmatism that's only concerned about what works, why does he waste all that? Why does God act that way? Because as Jesus says, these flowers are here in the field today, and tomorrow they're thrown into the oven. What's he mean? Well, the dry spell comes on, and the heat takes them, and they wither up, and boom, they're gone. Why does God put all that effort and energy and beauty and elegance and splendor into these flowers when they're here today and gone tomorrow? What a waste, we would say. Who knows why God does that, but he does things we think strange and delightful. But Jesus' point is, if God clothes something like those flowers that are just here for a moment of time, as it were, how much more? You see, if God feeds dirty birds, and if he decks out daily flowers, think how much more you are worth. Day. So there's an argument from value. Now then Jesus goes on, he says, there's also the argument from, we'll call it utility. You see it in verses 25 and 26. That is, what works or what is of use. And Jesus says, which of you by being anxious is able to add one span or one cubit, like about 18 inches, a foot and a half, onto his span of life? It's probably not stature he's talking about here, but he's probably talking about your span of life. And he's saying, now which of you, by being anxious, by tensing up your stomach muscles and furrowing your brow and concentrating real hard and worrying your most, can add, as it were, 18 inches on your chronological timeline? Well, obviously, it's not going to extend your life at all by being anxious. That anxiety has no power. It might take a good bit off your life, but it's not going to add any to it. It doesn't work. That's kind of like this movie. I think it was called Tiger Town. It was about the little fellow who was a Detroit Tigers fan. And one of the things his father told him in the movie was that something like this: if you really want something, if you really want it to happen, if you want it hard enough, it'll happen. I hope you dads don't ever tell your kids that. But in the movie, it worked a bit. You know, he went to the stadium and the star hitter and slugger was in a slump. And so this little fella got there, he closed his eyes and he really scrunched up his mental powers and he folded his hands and he was thinking, wanting, wishing. And lo and behold, the crack of the bat. And there was a double off the wall or home run or whatever. But that's the movies. It doesn't work. We did it at an Orioles game this summer. And we went like that. And the guy was out several times. That's what Jesus is saying. Who of you, by being anxious, can produce even that much on your lifespan? It doesn't work. Anxiety has no power to produce like that. It's the argument from utility. And Jesus says, not only that, but there's an argument from what we could call priority. And you see it in about verses 29 to 31, where he says, "And you, don't seek what you should eat or what you should drink, and don't be of anxious mind, for the pagans of the world keep seeking all these things, but your Father knows you have need of these things. Instead, keep on seeking His kingdom," etc. Now, what Jesus is saying is, you have a certain priority, and you are not supposed to ape the pagans around you. He says the pagans around you basically keep on seeking these things. What things? Well, food and drink and the necessities of life. That absorbs their attention, basically. He's saying you need to be distinct. Don't blend with the group. Instead, keep seeking His kingdom. What's that mean? Well, that's a word addressed to disciples. Keep on seeking His kingdom. Only a disciple of Jesus can do that. Because kingdom, if you think, the basic sense of kingdom is kingship. It is that God rules. That's the basic sense of it. And so what Jesus seems to be saying is, keep on seeking God's kingship. That is, let Him rule and reign over every realm of your life. That's your first priority, not merely with the necessities of life, however important they are. But He wants you to be distinct from the pagans. We could say more and should about that, but for time's sake, we must rush on. But you have a different priority, Jesus says, than those around you. And that's not reflected if you just ape your culture of being concerned about food and drink and those necessities. Your Father knows you need them. And so Jesus is coming to us, appealing to us with rational arguments, with reasons. He's approaching our minds. And He's concerned about how we think. And He's saying, get your thinking straight. That's something about Christianity and Jesus, isn't it? If you're going to be a Christian, you need to be a thinking person. You don't leave your brain behind. Jesus isn't saying you need formal education. He's not saying that. He says a Christian disciple needs to be a thinker. He's not saying you need to be formally educated. There's a difference. He's saying you must be a thinker. Think! Consider the ravens. Consider the lilies. Get your thinking straight. Then you won't be a poor fool. Now, secondly, Jesus says, not only get your thinking straight, but He also says, remember who you are. Remember who you are. The story is told by Dr. Donald Gray Barnhouse, who was the one who told it. And I don't know if it was true or not, but the story was that on one occasion, Napoleon was standing looking at some papers, and he happened to let go of the bridle of his horse as he was looking at these papers, and all of a sudden the horse reared up and Napoleon's life was in danger, and a corporal who happened to be standing nearby leaped and grabbed the bridle and brought the horse under control. Napoleon turned to him and saluted him and said, "Thank you, Captain." And the corporal picked up on the new rank and he said, "Of what company, sire?" Napoleon said, "Of my guards." With that, The former corporal stooped down, picked up his musket and flung it away, started walking, pacing across the field, tearing off his corporal's stripes as he went, took his place among the officers of Napoleon's staff, who asked him, "What are you doing here?" He says, "I'm a captain of the guards." "At whose order?" He said, "By the emperor's order." He knew who he was. He was a captain, and he acted on it. And that's what Jesus is saying here in verses 29 to 32. Remember who you are. Well, who am I? Well, Jesus gives you some pictures if you look there. He says in verse 30, you don't need to ape the pagans because your Father knows that you need these things. Well, if he's my Father, who am I? I'm a child of the Father who knows I need these things. And it's the Father's responsibility, ultimately, to provide for the child. But who am I? I'm not just a child of the Father. I'm also a sheep of the shepherd. Jesus said in verse 32, don't be afraid, little flock, because your Father delights to give you the kingdom. We're a little flock, as he looked upon his disciples. A little flock of sheep is defenseless. But Jesus is assuming if they're his flock, then the individuals in it are one of his sheep. And the sheep always has a shepherd. And that's who I am. I'm a sheep with a shepherd. And it's the shepherd's responsibility to provide for and to protect the sheep. Now, who am I? Well, he tells me to keep on seeking his kingdom. And at the same time as seeking his kingdom, he also says that it's the Father's delight to give you the kingdom. Now, if there's a kingdom, and if God is the king, who am I? Why, I'm a subject of the king. And so I'm a child of the Father, and I know that the Father must provide for me. That if he's going to be a decent father, he needs to provide. And so that's his responsibility, basically. And I'm a sheep of the shepherd. I may be defenseless and fragile, but the shepherd is strong. And he's not a hired man who runs off and leaves the sheep. He's the shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep, and he's going to protect the sheep. And I'm a subject of the king. And if I'm a subject of the king, it's the king's duty to defend and protect and provide for the welfare of his subjects. If I remember who I am, I won't have this overwhelming anxiety about what I eat and drink, etc., etc. Sometimes, again, not to bring the birds in, but sometimes the birds do better than that. At least in that poem, you know, you've probably heard, said the robin to the sparrow, "I should really like to know why these anxious human beings rush about and worry so." Said the sparrow to the robin, "I think that it must be because they have no heavenly Father such as cares for you and me." Remember who you are, and you will never be a poor fool. And then Jesus says, not only get your thinking straight and remember who you are, but exercise your freedom. Exercise your freedom. He says in verses 33 and following, we just take the first part of 33, sell your possessions and give alms, etc. What's he saying? Is he saying that all his disciples have to sell all their possessions and give them away? No, that's not required in what Jesus says, because he doesn't want to create a whole bunch of paupers who are then dependent on others. That don't make Jesus ridiculous, but it is radical. He is saying if you're not bound, if you're not preoccupied like the pagans are with the necessities of life and making a living, as we call it, and food and drink, etc., if you're not preoccupied and fixated on that, then you're free. If you seek his kingship in all your life, and your first goal is to please him, why then, sell your possessions and give alms. You can let some of those go, and you can give. That's a nice contrast, isn't it? You notice the operative word, as they sometimes call it, in that parable of the rich fool. One concern, where I can store my goods. And Jesus is saying to his disciples, sell and give. Store versus sell and give. You see the contrast there. If once we're set free, then we can do that. You can exercise your freedom. Have you ever seen someone who's preoccupied? Do you know how difficult sometimes it is to set someone free from that? A classic illustration of that stands out to me was when my father was still in the pastorate and Barbara and I were back for some reason visiting my parents. And so happened, you'll have to forgive us, but on that particular day, there happened to be an episode of roller derby on TV. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen that, but what roller derby is, you have about at least two teams that go around in an oval, roller skating around on that. And the objective is for one team to try to eliminate the other team in any way they can. I mean, if one member comes up behind somebody else, then you just give them the elbow and try to knock them flat. Sometimes they shove them. It's a terribly vicious thing, and none of you ought to ever watch it. Now, however, it happened to be on that particular day, and my father had never seen roller derby before. He was just a gawk at it. He couldn't take his eyes off of it. He was preoccupied. In fact, there was a gentleman in the congregation by the name of Mr. McClellan, and Mr. McClellan happened in while we were watching roller derby. And Mom brought him in, and she said to my father, Mr. McClellan's here. And I don't know if you've ever seen anybody that has kind of a faint smile and a blank look on their face, but he turned, saw that indeed some person was there, and he turned right back and he watched. He just couldn't be released from that. He couldn't be taken away. He was preoccupied. He was taken up. He was fixated with roller derby. And obviously, poor Mr. McClellan could only get a few words. Not with my dad, but my mother and I myself made him feel comfortable and at home. And my mother thanked me for making the best out of a very difficult social situation. You see, it's a real grip, this preoccupation. And even poor fools can be gripped like that. But if once we get our thinking straight, if we remember who we are, it sets us free. We can risk something on the fidelity of God. Sell your possessions and give alms. That's what the New Testament is telling us about, you know, in Ephesians 4:28, when it gives it to us in a nutshell. Paul talks about, you know, a fellow who's been converted to Christ. He used to be a thief. He says, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with the one who is in need. There you see it. Why? What is there? Well, this thief is no longer a thief. He's a Christian, and so he's honest. He doesn't steal anymore. There's honesty. But that's not enough. Paul says, let there be industry. Let him labor, working with his hands. He'll be able to provide for himself and his own needs. So there's honesty, and then there's industry. But that's not everything. Why does he labor working with his hands? Not just to provide for himself, but in order that he might have to share with the one who is in need. It's not just honesty, it's not just industry, but it's generosity. And that's why we seek to work and labor as well, so that we can give. So, if you're set free, and if you're submitting to the kingship of God and every area of your life, as you have opportunity, risk something on the fidelity of God. Give something to somebody in need. Our Father, we pray that you would make us able really to think on the ravens and on the lilies. And that you would renew our minds. And that you would help us to enjoy the good gifts you give us. And yet never be so wrapped up in the gifts
that we do not belong to the giver. Amen.